This episode is brought to you by GetMobile ID, the smart choice for MDL implementations. Put citizens in control with GetMobile ID. Fully ISO compliant and UL certified for all transaction modes. Learn more at getgroupna.com. Welcome to AmbaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Amba community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, we are talking about First Amendment auditors. And if you don't know what that phrase means, by the time we get to the end of this episode, you will. Joining me is Brandy Duncan, the general counsel with the South Carolina Department of Motor Vehicles, and Casey Lee from the Iowa DOT, particularly the Division of Motor Vehicles. Casey, Brandy, welcome to your first appearance on the AmbaCast.
Thank you. I'm very excited. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So First Amendment auditors, it's a phrase that's coming up more and more amongst our membership in the community. Who would like to define that phrase for us and our listeners?
Have at it, Brandy.
So First Amendment auditors can frequently be associated also with our sovereign citizens, although they are not always the same group or the same population. But in short, First Amendment auditors are people who believe that they have a First Amendment right, and frankly, purpose to come into public areas and to film and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. So in the government context, usually what they're saying is, I'm coming in to audit to make sure essentially you're doing your job correctly, you're doing it efficiently, you're doing it in an open manner with the public, and you're not, you know, unlawfully hiding things. And the reason we call them First Amendment auditors is because they assert that they have this right under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, in particular, two key parts of that, the part that deals with abridging the freedom of speech and the right to free press.
So despite the name, which I'm going to come back to in a moment, we are talking about individual private citizens who are walking into government offices. In the case, in the context of our membership, a DMV, often a DMV branch office, they're coming in with recording devices, sometimes as simple as a phone, sometimes more sophisticated cameras and microphones, to record what is going on.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct.
And then what? Go ahead.
And then posting on social media.
Right, that's my next point. What are they doing with this stuff they're recording?
Yeah, so for some of them, I think the motivation is more so about that content creation and the clicks and maybe the money they can earn out of that. And maybe they're not so much so motivated by protecting their First Amendment rights. So it's kind of the motivations, I suppose, can be a bit different depending on the individual. Same as with sovereign citizens, their motivations are a little bit different too, but I think for most of them that's their end goal, is to get an entertaining video out of the interaction.
So if they're jumping on this bandwagon primarily to create the content for whatever end goal it is, when we use that phrase First Amendment auditors, are we inadvertently legitimizing what they're doing? I mean, we use the term auditing a lot in government, and it's usually for a very legitimate required function. Now, I know they're claiming, I'm a First Amendment auditor, I'm here to ensure government transparency, but we know, as Casey just explained, in most cases, that's not really what's going on.
Right. Casey's right. A lot of them, especially the ones that do post directly onto social media like YouTube, they are absolutely looking for clicks, because the more clicks and views they get, the more money they get. And that is actually a huge part of this group. We know that there are some auditors who easily make $150,000 a year doing this.
Just generating this content and having the views.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. But you know, for ease of conversation, I think more so, or ease of discussion within our agencies, I think that's why a lot of us sort of default to this term. I can assure you that, at least for me personally, the use of the term First Amendment auditor does not convey any actual authority or belief that they have any legitimate governmental purpose for being there. Yeah. Certainly, they claim that they are journalists, even though they're not part of what we would consider the traditional press or the normal press. But as we know over time, things evolve in our society too. So, 20 years ago, we never would have considered somebody who is a social media influencer to have any sort of legitimate business doing that. But I think most of us would recognize that as legitimate now.
So they're showing up uninvited, unannounced. And I think the reality is whatever we call them, we're now dealing with these folks coming into the offices. So I think the focus is how do you deal with these people that come in unannounced, sometimes disruptive, and to the nature of trying to get views, of course, they're hoping conflict, because the more conflict and the more interaction, the more exciting their video will go, it'll go viral, and here we go. And so I think that's where a lot of the conversation has come up now with our members is, okay, what do you do when these people show up? So Casey, how are you tackling this in Iowa?
We haven't seen a lot of it in Iowa. We've had a few interactions. But I think what we're really kind of approaching or preparing for these kinds of situations on a customer service training level, making sure that our staff are prepared to kind of handle that situation with the customer service skills, the grace to kind of make sure that the situation doesn't get out of control, but also that our staff feel empowered to be able to do those kinds of, have that kind of conversation, speak confidently to a First Amendment auditor who might be, getting very heated and calling out, you're violating my rights. Those situations can get escalated pretty quickly, but making sure, they have the customer service training, but they also are aware of the legal ramifications, the DPPA, things that are important for them to know. What kinds of information is it important for us to make sure that we're protecting the most?
Because it's one thing if they want to come in and record their own transaction, and then it's a complicating factor when they're recording other people, perhaps without their consent to be recorded, that's doing a transaction with an agent.
Absolutely. And to that point, Ian, what we've heard from the courts is that when we're talking about filming in public spaces, we can still can control for time, place, and manner, right? So yes, they can film in a public location, but for example, they can't break into our DMV at midnight to film in a public location. That's still going to be a burglary or a breaking and entering, but also manner, right? So are they filming in a way that is disruptive to our business operations? Are they filming in a way that does put the personal identifying information or PII of our other customers at risk of being disclosed without their consent? So you mentioned them filming even their own transaction. They absolutely can do that and post it on social media if they wish to. If I want to post my social security number all over Facebook,
sure,
I am allowed to do that, even under the Driver Privacy Protection Act.
It's your information.
Right. So they absolutely can film their own transaction. We've even had discussions.
By the way, we don't advise anybody putting their social security. Though truth is, social security numbers are out there for everybody to have, but that's another podcast for another day. But
right. We absolutely don't advise putting your PII out there. But I know that this week here at the 2024 Law Institute and Workshop, we've even had discussions about people wanting to film their skills test, their road test. As part of their own transaction with us. And so part of that discussion becomes, can they do that in a safe manner? And if they can, we don't necessarily have authority to say, no, you cannot film that. So these are all sort of ongoing conversations as we continue to flesh out this area of what's going on.
Yeah. And I think with recording their own transactions too, just the nature of our offices, it's not large space. It's not large working spaces. Computers are very close together. Conversations happening. So it would become very difficult for somebody to record their own transaction if there were other transactions going on and not inadvertently picking up some of that. So that's something we have to be really careful about, what somebody may even inadvertently be picking up.
So Brandy, Casey talked a little bit about preparing a customer service agent on how to deal with the situation, or others in the office. How does a branch manager deal with it? How does security deal with it? What are you seeing as some of the approaches that are happening in that space in terms of how to prepare for these folks coming into the office?
Right. So like most things, doing your research and your preparation ahead of time can really be the difference between successfully dealing with these situations versus not. One of the things that is very helpful is to go through all your DMV locations and make sure you have physically marked any place that is an employee-only area. Mm. Or that is an area that is maybe marked off or separated as if you are the customer being helped, you're allowed in this area. But if you are not actively being helped, you must stay behind this line or outside of this area. So maybe, you know, a 3, 4, 5 foot distance away from the front counter. And also around your knowledge testing stations, do you want to actively post signage that says there is no filming or photography happening in that area for test security purposes?
And is that allowed? You know, you mentioned earlier about the courts have decided that there's this inherent right for people to record in a public area. The ability to say you can't do it here because of the nauseous, does that fall into what you were getting about the exception of you can control time, place, manner? Those
yes.
might not have been the right words that
yes, very much so. And that's where that conversation even about PII comes into place, right? As long as you can put forth a good, justifiable reason for why you're trying to limit videography or photography in that particular area at that particular time, then the courts are generally probably gonna go with you. So for example, although you might have signs about not filming in the knowledge testing area, if nobody is in there taking a test at that moment, then maybe it's not a big deal. If they wander in there versus if somebody is actually taking a test and going up to them and saying, listen, we have the signs here because the test has to stay secure. And I actually recommend if you have to have those kinds of conversations, in addition to, of course, staying very calm, very professional, not raising your voice, not cursing, that sort of thing, kind of explaining in a very common sense way, the reason we ask you not to film in this area is because it puts our test at risk.
So it comes back to that training, because I'd imagine, Casey, training people to do what Brandy just said, which is to be calm, to be clear, because if they're not, if they're belligerent, and by them I mean the whoever in the branch office is talking to the quote-unquote First Amendment auditor, if they're not clear, if they're not calm, if they become belligerent, that is what's being recorded. And all of a sudden now it's a viral video of DMV, you know, throws us out and is outrageous.
Right. And that's probably kind of what they're trying to get to, is one of those, you know, you're raising emotions that way.
Yeah.
The way they're talking to DMV staff to try and get those emotions raised to get a reaction. And so I think training wise, I mean, how do you training for that is some, you know, role playing, showing videos of these situations. I think that's a good eye opener for staff to know that this is happening, that this is a thing, you know. Otherwise, if it's not maybe something common knowledge, unless you're on YouTube searching and finding those videos. Cause I mean, on it personally, if I had to, which video to choose to watch on YouTube, I probably wouldn't choose. That wouldn't be my first choice.
Your algorithm's not popping these up as suggestions.
No, but, I mean, obviously there is an audience for it, but even just, at this, you know, in our presentation the other day, watching a couple of these videos, you listen to it, and I don't know if it's because of the roles that we're in and that what we're trying to do within our jobs, but just I'm not a confrontational person in the slightest. I'm probably the least intimidating person that you might ever meet. But I listen to that and I get fired up. I'm like, well, you know, protective, like I want to protect that staff and those customers who are sitting in that office from this belligerent person who's just trying to be like, you know, just openly mean. And maybe it's because that, you know, Iowa nice is something that's ingrained in me. But so I don't know what South Carolina, what kind of the culture is a little, I don't know if it's a little different there. But yeah, I think it would just preparing staff that it could happen and letting them know that, yes, this is a thing, this exists, and it could happen to us too.
Mm-hmm. Right. To that point, I'd also encourage jurisdictions, if you don't already have a policy written about photography or videography in your public spaces, you might want to create one, and one that doesn't address just First Amendment auditors, but all filmography, right? So we know we have news stations that come to us sometimes and want to film inside our DMVs. In fact, we had a reality TV show that wanted to film inside of one of our DMVs, wanted to film a customer basically going in to take their knowledge test. And so we have processes for how we coordinate that ahead of time. And having a generic policy like that can be very helpful for dealing with these situations, especially if you get into litigation later. And you do need to always be thinking this could potentially go to litigation if things
says
go
the
south.
Attorney.
Yeah. If things go south, that could happen.
But you said we've heard from the courts, so there has been some litigation, I presume, already on this.
Yes, it has primarily been in the law enforcement context, and primarily in what we would think of as more traditional public forums, so outside, you know, in roadways, stuff like that. But we are definitely starting to see litigation where it's happening in places that are more like our DMV branch office locations, and just similar situations to that. Yeah. So we're getting more guidance, but they are all going back to time, place, and manner analysis, and how are they handling that? So, on the note of lawsuits, don't touch them. Do not touch these people or their cameras.
Oh, the people. I'm going to say don't touch the lawsuits. No. You mean one of the key parts of the training is when you're interacting with them, no matter how hostile it might get.
Yes. Do not touch a First Amendment auditor or their camera or their belongings. Just don't touch their things. Yeah. There was actually a case not too long ago where there was not appropriate signage. So a First Amendment auditor went into areas we would think of as employee only areas, and a staff member, it was actually an attorney, kind of shoved him out of his office. And as I understand things, it resulted in a fairly sizable judgment that came out of that, even though the First Amendment auditor was not really injured, physically injured in a sense that we would consider.
Was a key part of that, back to your signage of where people can and couldn't go, is that even though it was clear from, I guess, cultural norms that it was not a place open to the public, there was no signage that said employees only past this point or unauthorized access or anything of that nature.
Exactly. And you can even see on some of the videos, some of the First Amendment auditors themselves will be whispering under their voice, oh, you see that area right there? They should have a sign there that says we can't go back there.
They're figuring out the game.
Right, because they don't have a sign. We could go back there and we wouldn't be breaking the law, but we're not going to push it that far today.
Interesting. So they're going in and scoping it out, and they're recognizing where maybe the markings aren't what they should be and taking advantage of that.
Absolutely. And to that point, you know, if you do find a video of one of your audits on YouTube or some other platform, it is useful to go ahead and watch it. I recommend watching it and video recording it at the same time so that you don't have to continue to give them clicks. But but that way you can play it back as many times as you want to analyze, but to listen and see what they say, to see what that interaction is. It's useful for potential litigation. It's useful for figuring out what we do right, what could we do better. Yeah. And it's useful for looking at, are there additional places we need signage or additional places we should store documents or data or should not? Yeah. You know, just doing kind of all that after action review and analysis.
Now, I know a lot of these, generally speaking, it's very obvious that somebody is doing it. However, I would imagine there's also sometimes the more hidden camera approach.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
How does that change? How do you handle it when someone is not being upfront and transparent that they're doing these activities? Does it change the time, place, or manner equation? You know, it's one thing to say, I am here, I am doing this, and I'm recording it, and now it kind of sets a context versus someone who is not disclosing they're doing it. Or does that not matter at all?
I don't think it matters legally speaking.
Yeah.
It doesn't change necessarily how we'll react. In some ways, it might actually make the interaction less confrontational, less eventful, and therefore less likely to be posted. And so, you know, as long as you can tell they're complying with all your normal time, place, and manner restrictions you would give to somebody who broadly announces what they're doing, maybe you don't even say anything to them.
Now, what I've heard is there's been two general schools of thought, which is you train people to interact with them and allow them to do their thing within the confines of what is reasonable, what's marking, and you don't create any confrontation. There's another school of thought that says as soon as someone is identified as videoing, there are jurisdictions that the instructions are stop everything in the office, announce to the office, we have ceased operations due to someone who has decided to record our activities, which we do not support. And until that person leaves, we are not resuming operations. And part of the idea there is to get the customers to turn to you band against the First Amendment auditor and get them to leave because everybody else here wants to get their business done. Are you hearing that as well, as these are kind of the two fundamental approaches that jurisdictions are going with?
Yeah, we've heard. Well, we've heard from it's Pennsylvania, who kind of, we've seen videos of that approach, and in our policy, our audio, video, and recording policy includes that as an option, kind of as an escalated option. If you've warned, you know, to our staff, if you've warned somebody multiple times, ask them to stop. You know, ask them, the explaining to them clearly that they are, you know, you are possibly, you are in an area where you might be recording somebody else's personal information. We cannot have that. If they're continuing on, that is an option that we give our staff, to stop all operations, to stop transactions or the possibility for somebody's information to be captured on video.
And do you announce it to everyone
That's not in the policy, the okay. Announcing it, you know, to the room. Given the situation, I think we would give our staff, our supervisors, the ability to do that if they felt it was necessary. But that's it's definitely an interesting tactic to try and get the rest of the room in on it too. So,
right. I will say we saw a video of a management team from Pennsylvania doing that during one of the sessions yesterday. And they were not interacting with the First Amendment auditor to make this announcement. Literally, they were making the announcement to the other customers, but they were doing it in a very kind of matter-of-fact, non-confrontational manner. And they were also very upfront that the reason we have to stop operations is for the protection of your personal identifying information, because it might accidentally be caught on audio or video, and we cannot take that risk. But as soon as they stop filming, we will immediately resume operations and get you taken care of as quickly as possible. We did have some customers in that video who started kind of yelling at the First Amendment auditor, telling them, can you get out? We need to get our business done.
For sure.
I did specifically ask Pennsylvania if they've had anything kind of beyond yelling or confrontation like that. And they said, no, not yet. But I do think if you decide to take that approach, you need to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, if the First Amendment auditor keeps pushing and insisting on staying there, things could escalate, things could get very ugly.
And back to your point about making sure you don't initiate any physical contact, especially in places, there are increasingly more and more DMV branches where they are bringing in physical security, whether it's security guards or some states that are partnering with their state police to have officers in the branch offices, and certainly as things escalate, that's, you know, really making sure people are trained to react and not initiate is going to become a even more critical path.
Yes, I would agree. You know, if there ends up being a physical confrontation, you know, between the First Amendment auditor and a customer, basically let that start first before our staff get involved at all.
I was thinking more between you know, the state personnel having the conversation and responding to them being belligerent. I hadn't even thought about the fact that there could be an incident between the auditors and the other customers who are just there trying to get their business done.
Yeah. Because I think just the nature of what we do, sometimes we have upset customers. Sometimes we might have a situation where our staff maybe even detects fraud. So yeah, it's not unheard of to have some law enforcement presence or to need that assistance in one of our offices to begin with. So at least we have that preparation in place for our staff.
Very good. Mm-hmm. We know it's happening more. We know cultural trends would suggest it's going to expand. But how much is it happening? Do we have a sense about how often, how regular, how widespread this really is?
I mean, I know I have a sense in South Carolina how frequently it's happening.
Well, let's start there. How frequently is it happening in South Carolina?
So roughly about once a month, if you average it out. Yeah. But one of the trends we're seeing is that they will, you know, hit two or three or four branch offices in succession, or that they'll be coordinated to hit two or three or four of them kind of all at once. So one of the things that I do always recommend is once the audit starts, as soon as a management team member can let somebody higher up know who's not physically in the branch, that's a good thing, because then they can warn the other locations right around there. If you have security cameras, they can have somebody start watching on the security cameras so that if things do escalate and law enforcement needs to be called, somebody remotely can do that if necessary. And forewarning your other branches, it just gives them a moment to kind of tell their staff this might happen. It gives them a moment to kind of refresh their memories very quickly about how to handle it. And to that point, California actually created kind of a one-page cheat sheet mm-hmm. to remind their staff. It's actually a half-page thing that has stuff on the front and back, but just to remind their staff about what these people can and cannot do, what their staff should and should not do. And I found that to be very, very helpful. And think that's a great model to consider for your locations.
Yeah. Just one more thing for these poor customer service representatives at the counter to have to learn and know what we keep piling onto them is just is mind blowing sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. What else? We've mentioned a lot of tips and tricks and best practices that are starting to evolve. Are there other areas that members should start thinking about or best practices you've seen, like your California example, that we haven't touched on yet?
So I would say I definitely think you need to look into your state laws, but also look to see if you have county ordinances or municipal ordinances that might provide greater protections than you actually see under state law. We've also seen a trend in South Carolina where when they're doing the audit, they're also going to try to do a Freedom of Information Act request at the same time. They don't normally bring anything with them to do it. So if nothing else, if you don't have, they'll ask for the form to do it, right? If you don't have a form that really fits whatever they're asking for, just give them a blank piece of paper. It's easier than arguing with them. Mm-hmm. We've also seen them in South Carolina entering now with masks set up kind of like a balaclava so that really all you can kind of see is their eyes. And on our most recent audit, when they did that, they you can hear them before they even enter the building talking about that they're doing this to test how we're going to react since masks have been required for so long because of the pandemic, which they weren't really required. In South Carolina for that long. Yeah. It was, certainly optional.
So what are they expecting? What are they hoping is going to happen in that reaction related to masking themselves?
I think they're hoping and expecting that there's going to be a confrontation ordering them to take their mask off, which the interesting thing in South Carolina is we actually have a statute that says you cannot enter government buildings with a mask on for the purpose of concealing your identity. So, certainly if somebody's coming in with a medical mask on to prevent infection and whatnot,
you can tell what the purpose is.
Right. We can tell that it's not to conceal their identity. So part of that conversation or thought process becomes, well, do you tell them, look, there's a law that says you can't enter with a mask on for the purpose of concealing your identity. So can you just tell me your name? That way we know you're not wearing the mask to conceal your identity. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them will not want to do that even at that point.
Probably not. Yeah. Probably not. And so then, of course, the analysis becomes, do we go ahead and call law enforcement and say this person won't tell us who they are with the mask on? And
I think, the mask complicates it for me, too, just because, if somebody were to charge in with a mask, holding a camera or holding something up, my first impression would be hit the deck. This person has violent intentions, just with the nature of all that we hear in the news, the fear that's perpetuated of what might happen and the instances that keep happening all over the country. That would be my first fear, is that somebody's got some really violent intentions coming into one of our offices. So, I hope that we don't see much more of that with the masks. It just sounds terrifying.
Well, I think it scared our staff quite badly. I can assure you it scared some of our customers quite badly because all the customers that were in that office when it happened immediately stood up and left and went outside. There was only one customer who stayed, and it was like nothing was going on. He was just continuing to fill out his paperwork to get his transaction done. And actually during that event, our FedEx guy actually showed up to pick up our FedEx for the day and drop our FedEx off and whatnot. He thought it was a robbery because he didn't know the context. And so he immediately called police. and police showed up. Now, we did see them do an interesting technique. As soon as they figured out it was a First Amendment audit, one of the officers pulled out his cell phone and turned on a song quite loud so that, number one, it would kind of ruin their video, but number two, perhaps get copyright issues going on the video so that it wouldn't be able to post.
Wouldn't be here. Sweet Caroline's a good option because we'd know that one's copyright protected.
Yeah, so we thought that was an interesting technique.
Everybody loves Neil Diamond, but, again, another podcast for another day.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting technique when I figured out why he was doing it.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one before. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, that caused me to think, what if there's probably some locations that just automatically have a radio playing all day long anyway, because the staff prefer that. Mm-hmm. Like you go into the grocery store and there's always music playing. Mm-hmm. I feel like when I go into a grocery store and there's not music playing, it feels odd. So if that were a tactic that really helped by having music playing all the time, I think that could be, something that maybe could be shared with other DMVs if it's something that works.
Sure, absolutely. And maybe when they show up, we just turn that music up.
Well, now we're all of a certain age where the music in the supermarket in the DMV is actually our music. So I'm turning up that volume.
That's true.
Might put people in a better mood in our office too, maybe.
Oh, goodness. That would be good.
Great. Brandy, Casey, thanks for chatting with me a little bit about this new emerging area that is very quickly getting a lot of attention. And I think we're only at the beginning of really discovering what's going to be the impact of our operations and putting together some best practices and tips and tricks on how members could really prepare their staff, do training, have the right policies and procedures in place so that when they do start going to court, which I think you're right, Brandy, they're going to, that they can show due diligence and that these were not arbitrary decisions.
Yes, absolutely. And I would encourage anybody who is listening to this to go on the ANVIL website and access the materials from the First Amendment auditor training that we've done at the Law Institute and workshop this week. There's some really great information in there, as well as links to some really good videos of First Amendment audits that have been done.
So if you haven't had a chance to see any of them, here's a way to go and see it without necessarily clicking it on YouTube.
Exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. But there was great information in there for people to look at.
Great. Well, though we don't want you to click on YouTube, we do want you to download our podcast. So, don't follow them on YouTube, but follow us here at the ANVICast. Brandy, Casey, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Thank you all for listening this week. As always, thanks to our producers, Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin. Till next week, stay well.
Thank you for joining us for ANVICast, hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey and Chelsea Hadwin, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Get Mobile ID by Get Group North America. Visit us at anvicast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.